Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Two New York theater institutions have new leaders, Classic Stage Company and New York Theater Workshop, both of them women, by the way. Jill Rafson took over as producing artistic director at Classic Stage Company in June, becoming CSC's seventh artistic director, but only the second woman in its position, in that position. CSC, which is known for reimagining classic works of theater, will launch its new season on October 11th with a revival of the musical A Man of No Importance, followed by Black Odyssey, a Harlem-based reimagining of the Greek myth. Now, at New York Theater Workshop, the new artistic director is Patricia McGregor, one of the few Black women leading a nonprofit theater. She succeeded James Nicola, who had led the theater group since 1988 and had overseen the pre-Broadway runs of hits like Rent, Slave Play, Hadestown, and Once. The NYTW's 2022-23 season is already underway, with the production of American Television's running through mid-October. Going to have that on the show next week. And a revival of Merrily We Roll Along, starring Jonathan Groff, Lindsay Mendez, and Daniel Radcliffe, set for November. Working on that one. Joining me now to talk about stepping into their new roles and what they have planned are New York Theater Workshop Artistic Director Patricia McGregor. Patricia, nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
And CSC Producing Artistic Director Jill Rafson. Hi, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So many of our members of our audience may not know exactly what an artistic director does. And of course, that same job title can differentiate between different places and even between different artistic directors. How do you see your role as artistic director at New York Theater Workshop?
I think of it in concentric circles. So my primary role is to curate a season. So we have five slots, and my primary role is to bring my artistic sensibilities and figure out where that meets the values and ethos of the theater, solicit new work, honor the work that has been brought to the table and is in the pipeline, and vision a season. So curatorial, my curatorial role is central. Within that, I also think a lot about how to create the art of belonging. And so we as a theater, as a field, I think one of our unique positions is that we have the ability to fight social isolation within the artistic community and within our larger civic duty. And so while I have these five slots, and unique to the workshop, we also have a really robust catalog of readings and workshops and developmental opportunities. So to figure out how we can welcome people in and give them the art of belonging outside of just those five slots. But how do I make sure the intersection of audiences, artists, new and old, can have a sense of a place to belong? And so while my main role is curatorial, I think a lot about curating the art of belonging, and by doing that, really serve our civic function in a variety of ways.
Jill, how do you think about the role of artistic director?
I love what Patricia said about the art of belonging, and I'm certainly going to be borrowing that down the line. I think that the curatorial role is a huge part of it. And I think my sort of version of belonging is creating community and creating opportunities between the productions. So I think that the difference, particularly for nonprofit theaters, and the role of the artistic director there is to not just put up a play and then ask your audience to go home and talk about it amongst themselves. It's what else can we do to deepen that experience, to deepen their engagement with each other and with the art that's being put on our stages? What are the conversations that can be sparked before they get to our space, in our space, and after they leave? And so providing that sort of holistic experience. So we think a lot about what are the tools that go along with that, and what is that other kind of programming that goes with the shows themselves? And also, I think just trying to make an argument for the essentiality of live theater. That feels like a big part of it, getting everyone excited about it. Our industry is really wonderful and collaborative, and we all believe in it so greatly. But I think that in making arguments for funding and for getting our current audience to come back after the pandemic, to bring in new audiences, we also constantly have to be thinking about just making a case for ourselves and why you should get off your couch and come into our spaces.
Patricia, you've been what the New York Theater Workshop fondly refers to in its literature as a usual suspect, someone who has engaged with the company and has worked with them in the past. You know, that's a choice for you. That was something that you obviously had lots of opportunities. What made you keep returning to New York Theater Workshop as a collaborator before you got this gig?
Well, I remember so distinctly first being outside the door of the workshop and having heard of the work, and I didn't have the codes to the door yet. And then I think my first invitation was Liz Diamond invited me inside to do a reading. And then I was invited by Jim to direct my own reading. And so there was a whole process up until getting to be a usual suspect. And I think participating in the usual suspect is really in many ways the seed of the art of belonging to me. Because even though I moved at a certain point in my career and I didn't go to all of the shows or the opportunities to collaborate and be in community, but I had a place to belong. And the Usual Suspects program, which we're really thinking about, how do we continue with the size and scale that it's at to continue to give that intimate sense of belonging? I think that's central to why I kept coming back when I did. And even when I wasn't there, I felt a deep sense of belonging. And so what's drawn me back in the most robust way, which is being here as the artistic director, is because I can follow the track where I belonged at all different ages and career levels. And I want to continue that for the 21-year-old me who stood outside of the door and didn't know the codes. I want to distribute the codes to as many people as possible and give them the sense of belonging that I really benefited from in the last 20 years of my career.
So Jill, if someone's thinking, I've heard the name before, especially among the theater community, you were part of the team at Roundabout Theater Company since 2005. You served as associate artistic director there. What's the transition been like for you? And what are some of the tools that you learned there that you think you can bring over and help make CSC robust?
Yeah, you know, my career at Roundabout, who knew that I was going to be there for 17 years? But I got to experience every single different level of the organization because I really grew up there. I like to think of Roundabout as my grad school. And because of that, I know I can take with me the experience of having worked at every kind of job. It gives me a lot of empathy for my staff, hopefully, and just an appreciation of what everybody has on their plates and trying to keep that holistic viewpoint. Because I think that when you transition into a position like this, I can say this a whopping 3 months in so far, it is really easy to spend a lot of your days talking to the artists that you want to bring into your space, talking to the biggest supporters and the people who are really excited to make sure the work is happening. And the staff piece of the puzzle is just as important as anything else. And so it's I relate. I've done a lot of their jobs already along my trajectory. And so I like to keep that in mind. For me, the transition has also been working at an extremely large theater company for such a long time, and now coming to a theater that has a slightly more specific mission in just one theater space to program. That's a huge difference. I'm really happy to have gone to a smaller space, to an off-Broadway space, to have one theater building to be building programming around, because honestly, one of the attractions of coming to CSE was we have this gorgeous theater, the Lynn Engelson Theater on 13th Street, and the space itself just has this energy, and every director I talk to wants to come and play in here. And I love being able to offer that up and to be able to say, this is definitely the space that you're talking about. Dream with this in your mind as you're coming up with projects. And I'm excited about that. It's also just quicker to get things done, frankly, with fewer people around. I can see my entire staff from my desk, which is a very big change from my Roundabout days. And it's a lovely thing. And it just allows for a really different brand of collaboration.
My guests are Jill Rafson. She's the producing artistic director for Classic Stage Company, and Patricia McGregor, artistic director for New York Theater Workshop. So I'm going to ask both of you, Patricia, what was your gateway production? What was the first or second theater thing you saw and you thought, oh, okay, this is where I'm going to be?
I can speak to mine personally and mine at the workshop. Maybe I'll start with the workshop. I remember seeing Michael Garces directed a production of Light Raise the Roof. And among many things, it dealt with people who were unhoused and living in abandoned subway lines in New York City. And I, to this day, cannot pass certain parts in the subway and certain people and see a more expansive understanding of their journey and their humanity. And it woke me up in a way that I still feel challenged, empathetic and expanded by that journey. So I will say, like, in these particular walls, that was the first thing that I still hold with me. And in terms of my own life, I was born in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. So I also have a very probably Caribbean dance company, something that was in carnival, something that was in parade, was one of my first theatrical experiences. And so I'm always interested in what is the conversation of the sacredness of the work inside these walls, and also wanting to burst out as much as possible. And one of the things I love about this theater is I love the theater and I love the block that it's on, this East 4th Street block, where Mia at La Mama, and there's, you know, the Fab District, we have these closed streets, open doors Thursdays, where people like my theatrical beginning, which was on the streets, where the art happened on the streets and was fundamentally accessible to everyone. So there's a really great dynamic. I often say I love this theater itself, but I love the block that it's on and the celebratory element of not only the organizations that are on the block, but also the way in which the block is an extension of a performance space that is accessible for all. So that's the marriage of those two for me.
Jill, what was your gateway theater experience?
Oh, gosh. Well, for CSC, it was, I remember seeing Venus in Fur and coming to see that show. It wasn't my first time in the space, but it was the one that really unlocked for me this concept of, oh, the classics don't have to be what you think they are, which really, really stayed with me. This idea that you can take a story that has classic origins and tweak it in a lot of different ways. And I mean, one of the things I'm most excited about doing here is just expanding what we consider a classic and sort of reinvigorating the canon by giving today's most exciting voices access to those canonical materials and letting them mess around with them, whether that's a directorial voice or a playwriting voice. And Venus in Fur really showed me what you can do with an intimate space where the audience is, I think there's no seat in our theater more than 20 feet from the actors, just embracing that intimacy and seeing what that can do. And Venus in Fur, I remember being uncomfortably close to the action in a really wonderful way. For me personally, I was definitely the kid who grew up on musicals, and my mom recorded Into the Woods off of PBS, and I'm pretty sure I wore that VHS tape out. I watched that over and over and over again, and it's been really entertaining actually to watch that, the revival that's going on right now, and to see how many people I know who I didn't realize we all had this same sort of seminal unlocking moment where I didn't know I was watching a Stephen Sondheim musical back then. I just knew there was something in there that was telling me stories and that I was really into. And I was the weird kid who really liked Act Two when it got dark. And I just remember being absolutely fascinated by, oh, you're allowed to do this on stage. That's pretty cool.
I'm curious, you know, it's obviously there's a huge amount of people in the theater industry, but it's also small town feel as well. Everybody knows everybody or knows somebody. So I'm curious, you know, when a bunch of artistic directors get in a room, what do they talk about? I know when you get a bunch of radio people in the room, there's certain topics that tend to bubble up. Patricia, when you get a bunch of artistic directors, people in positions of power in theater, what tends to come up in conversation these days?
Well, one of the things I love, I mean, it's the first time I've been at the table in this particular position. And one of the things that I think is exciting is, particularly in the pandemic, there have been far more collectives of artistic directors trying to brainstorm and dream. And my mom was a union worker, so I think of collective action all of the time. And it feels like there's been more collective action. And I, who've been to some of these breakfasts and dinners and calls, have really been thinking about how we see ourselves as restaurants rather than sports teams. I think there can sometimes be this kind of competitive sense, and some of that is about, you know, wanting the best material. But I think if we can think of ourselves as like great restaurants and understanding our particular position in the ecosystem, and a lot of, to your question, what's coming up is how can we hold each other up? How can we actually make the case for the relevance and the funding and hold each other up? How do we come back in this continued pandemic? What does it mean to take the things that we've learned from the pandemic, from the long overdue racial reckoning? What does it mean to face some of the financial crisis that our individual organizations are facing, and also still allow for ourselves to do the programming that is robust, that is provocative, and that will help to be hopefully some of the provocation and the medicine that this moment needs. So what's really exciting to me is I, as a person who like to work in a very collective way, I'm excited that it seems there are more of those conversations happening now than there have been in a long period of time. And I think that will all be for the good.
Jill, you want to weigh in? Conversations you've noticed have come up?
Yeah. I mean, I think number one, you're absolutely right. This industry is not as big as people may think it is. You know, Patricia and I worked together in our previous jobs. You know, me as a producer of Roundabout Underground and her as a director there, and everything comes around again. I completely echo the sentiment that something about the last two and a half years has brought out more of a spirit of collaboration than I've ever seen. And I think it's allowing, especially with a lot of leadership transition, it's not just us, but there's a lot happening around New York and certainly nationally. It's giving this generation of artistic leaders a reason to get together, to be able to say, we have been at a moment of crisis and how do we hold each other up? And I think that there's going to be a lot more work on behalf of the artists that we serve to come up with ideas that we can do as a group, because we can get a lot more done when there are several theaters behind an initiative. And so I'm excited to see what those collaborations look like. I just have felt that some of the silos and walls have come down in a way I've never seen before. And yes, there's still that sort of sense of competition, but I think it's forcing people to define themselves better, to figure out, well, what am I doing that's different? How do I serve the community in a different way? What kind of art do I want to be making? And talking to each other about what everyone's goals and ambitions are, it helps to reveal some of those answers. I mean, it also just blew my mind that getting together with all of these artistic directors, I went to my first one of these gatherings a few weeks back, and it was so joyous. And the message I got from a lot of folks was, it can be a little lonely. These jobs can be a little bit lonely. And so it's really important to have other folks who are doing this and trying to figure it all out and being able to admit we don't have all the answers and that we can call upon each other's wisdom to try to keep our institutions moving forward and constantly growing. And it was really incredible to sort of realize that support system was there and people were just so wonderful and willing to have their brains picked. And I'll be taking them all up on it.
My guests are Jill Rafson and Patricia McGregor. We are talking about their new positions. Jill is the new producing artistic director at Classic Stage Company. Patricia McGregor is currently artistic director at New York Theater Workshop. We'll have more after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're talking about two New York theater institutions that have new leaders, Classic Stage Company and New York Theater Workshop. My guests are Patricia McGregor, the artistic director at New York Theater Workshop, and Jill Rafson, producing artistic director at Classic Stage Company. Okay, so there's this big write-up about you, Patricia, when you get the gig in the New York Times. And one of the things you said was, you think about the workshop being, and here's your quote, both hyper-local in its roots and international in its reach. So how have you thought about embracing both the micro and the macro?
Yeah, so in some ways, thinking about the hyper-local, when I think even just on our street, for example, I heard just before we started the talk of Little Amal, this you know, extraordinary puppet that's going around the city. It's landing on our street the day we have the opening of American Television. And Mia and I spoke and we said, let's change around the order of timing so we can actually embrace that event and hold hands across the street. And we actually have an actor from our production who's going to go and have a moment because there is a thematic link. So there's a very direct, like very hyper-local way that I think about that. I also think that the area that we're in, it has a large Ukrainian population, mm-hmm. a large Spanish-speaking population, a large Mandarin-speaking population. How do we engage with both the racial and economic and cultural diversity in our area within our programming. So I think about that in that very hyper-local way. There are a lot of community members that I need to go and sit down and have coffee with. As important as the large donors and some of the long-term artists, as important as those conversations are, I really want to talk to the people in the community and see how we can be of service to this hyper-local community through our Art of Belonging and our art on stage. And then internationally, I have my mom's from London. I've done work at the National. In the next couple of months, we're having conversations with people in artists in South Korea and South Africa and London, and how I think that in terms of where we sit in the ecosystem, I think Jill is absolutely right, figuring out what is that unique position that we're in. And so doing cutting-edge visionary work, but that speaks to our very hyper-local area and then zooms way out in an international perspective. I think of it a lot as zooming in and zooming out as we think about programming. From my own experience, where we moved a lot growing up, I like to think, what block am I in and what world do I live in? And the hyperlocal and international are two lenses that I think about the world through and hopefully our work will engage with.
Jill, CSC is known for reimagining the classics, the classic works of theater. How do you feel about that word classic now that you are in this position? And how are you thinking about ways we can engage with the classics that make them feel modern and relevant and inclusive, honestly?
Yeah, talking about this definition of the classics has kind of become my favorite thing, because I just want to continue to expand what we mean by that word. I mean, listen, it's in the name of our company. And I was just saying to someone the other day, you can't walk away from the assumed classics, the already accepted canon, because so much work has already been done that is inspired by it and that has really created some of the most exciting work that's going on. You know, I keep thinking back to what Fat Ham did with Hamlet. Mm-hmm. You appreciate Fat Ham in a different way by knowing Hamlet. And so I do really believe that theaters in New York need to continue to produce those originals so that we can inspire the next generation of artists to continue to riff on them in really exciting ways that are specific to their time and their voice. But we also need to add to the canon. So that can happen in a couple of ways. I really am excited by the project of finding the voices who got lost to history along the way. Who are the people who were doing incredible work, but usually because of their identity, usually because of their lack of access, their work just hasn't been given the multiple productions that it takes to get their names familiar to people, to get the titles familiar enough that it feels right to put them on a big marquee. And so doing the work of elevating names like Alice Childress and Zona Gale and Susan Glasspell, there are all these, especially women, especially people of color, writers who need that opportunity. And by making the active choice to put those works on a New York stage, you're basically making the argument that they belong in the canon by giving them that kind of platform and hopefully inspiring other theaters to follow suit. That's one big part of it. But then also continuing to ask today's most exciting young directors to give their new interpretations to the texts that we all already think we know, not making them all become new play experts before we allow them to get their hands on the classics, which is a problem our industry needs to really focus on. And then also just continuing to ask today's most exciting writers to look at the classics and say, what do you want to do with this? Do you want to update it? Do you want to reimagine it completely? Do you want to turn it on its head? And commissioning them, giving them the opportunity to just be inspired by those works. And I think acknowledge what playwright Dave Harris has said to me is his literary ancestry. They all know these works. They came up reading a lot of the same plays. How do they honor and then be inspired by those in their own next work? So the definition of a classic is a moving target in the best possible way.
Patricia, what are the next two shows going up at New York Theater Workshop?
So we currently have American Televisions, which opens next week, which is a really beautiful, dynamic piece of a playwright who I knew when they were an undergrad at Yale. So while I've inherited this season, it's wonderful because there are so many artists that I've been tracking Victor for over 12 years in this project. So that's really exciting. And then we have Merrily We Roll Along, of course, the Stephen Sondheim piece starring Daniel Radcliffe, Jonathan Goff, you know, really exciting piece. And then after that, How to Defend Yourself. So I love, I could speak about the whole season, so I'm trying to answer I snuck a third one in there. I couldn't help myself. But I do, because what I love about the workshop and what I love about the curation is those three pieces alone show a tremendous amount of range and a tremendous amount of who is the initiating driver. Some of them are the writer. Some of them are the director. Some of them are a cohort. For example, in How to Defend Yourself, we have three directors in that piece. So as I think of the accessibility, the visibility, and the innovation, one of the things we're thinking about in the seasons and with this triad of directors is how do we innovate the form? So those are three of the pieces that are coming up next.
And we're going to have Victor Cazares and Ruben Polendo, the director of American Televisions, on our show next week. I'm going on Sunday. I'm really looking forward to it.
Fantastic.
Okay, Jill, your next two shows.
So we are in rehearsals right now for Man of No Importance, which is a musical from about 20 years ago by Lynn Aaron, Stephen Flaherty, and the late Terrence McNally. It is John Doyle's final show with CSC after having led this place as artistic director for the last several years. And so, like Patricia, I inherited a season that I'm very happy to be working on. This piece is just absolutely beautiful. It's set in Ireland in the 1960s, and it's about a closeted man who uses theater as his escape. And it's really beautiful and hopeful, and the music is gorgeous. I can't wait for people to see it. And then we have such a contrast after that with Marcus Gardley's Black Odyssey, which is a resetting of the Odyssey story in Harlem. And I first saw that piece in its world premiere in Denver, however many years ago, and I'm so excited that this is the New York premiere. It's a stunning piece of theater. It's just so incredibly theatrical, and it's going to look gorgeous in the space. Tickets will be on sale for that soon, and Man of No Importance starts previews on October 11th.
And then we will see you both back here in a year with your first program seasons.
We hope so.
Fantastic. Can't wait.
My guests have been Patricia McGregor, Artistic Director at New York Theater Workshop, and Jill Rafson, Producing Artistic Director of Classic Stage Company. Thank you for making time today.
Thank you
so much for having us.
On the way, we'll have more on performance next hour and how it affects the audience. We'll talk about Little Amal, a 12-foot-tall puppet who represents a Syrian refugee child. And up next, we continue our conversation about theater with set designer Beowulf Borat. Have you seen Come From Away, the pianist in Shakespeare in the Park? Then you've seen his work. Now, we'll hear how he does it. Next.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.